Welcome, 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 geeks and nerds, girls and boys, to a brand new episode of Geek to Me Radio. Tonight, we have my interview with legendary director Joe Dante. We'll talk about the 35th anniversary of The Burbs. We'll talk about the 40th anniversary of Gremlins. We'll talk about how you can meet him next weekend at Pensacon in Florida. All that and more. Stand by.
We're talking TV, comics and movies, and video games. Star Trek from Star Wars, we'll try to explain. There are 12 doctors, 4 Hogwarts houses, 1 ring rules them all. To be the greatest Pokemon master, you must catch them all. You must catch them all. Try to catch them all. Gotta catch.
And if you're driving around the greater St. Louis area tonight listening to us on the big 550 KTRS, hello to all of you. Thank you very much for tuning in. If you are streaming us on the KTRS app or on the website, or the KTRS website or other means, hello to all of you. No video tonight as Joey V is not in studio with me. This interview is a pre-recorded interview that I did a couple weeks ago with director Joe Dante. He's going to be coming up next weekend, the 24th and 25th, I believe, at Pensacon in Pensacola, Florida. I've covered this show before. Fantastic convention. If you get a chance to go, it'd be worth going just to meet Joe Dante alone, but there's a lot of other great guests who are going to be there. But Joe Dante agreed to do an interview, so we got to chat over the phone. I had a great conversation with him. He's just such a brilliant filmmaker. We got to talk about a lot of different topics, and I'm very pleased to share that interview with you right now. Right now, I've got the incredible, award-winning, legendary, I could go on with adjectives all day, I'm very excited to talk to director Joe Dante. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Keep going with those adjectives. I like it.
Stupendous, magnificent, amazing, uber talented. It's amazing. First of all, let me get this out of the way. You're going to be appearing at Pensacon in Florida, which is a fantastic convention. We've covered it the past several years. And anyone who's a fan of yours can come up and get something autographed, have a chat with you. I assume you'll be doing a panel or two.
I'm sure I'll do whatever they tell me to do. That's what I do when I go to these things. They just point me and I go there.
How have you enjoyed the convention circuit? Like, these cons are coming up all over the place, and it's been a lot of fun.
There's all sorts of cons, you know. I mean, some of them are like Comic-Con in San Diego is so huge that it's kind of overwhelming. But some of the small ones, we actually get to meet the fans and talk to them. I find much more rewarding because, you know, if it wasn't for the fans, none of us would be doing this stuff.
Right. And you've got so many fans. I mean, I posted on my socials that I'd be talking to you, and people were just bombarding me with questions to ask. Just when you look at the career you've had, I want to point out a quote that I say is attributed to you. You said, I'm not sure how long ago this was either, a lot of people who are in the movie business don't really know much about movies, and they certainly don't know movie history. You can't use references that you would use with somebody when talking with somebody who knows movie history. Do you find that the wellspring of production houses and streaming services, and I feel like we're getting bombarded through a fire hose of content, do you feel that has helped or hurt this situation you originally quoted?
Well, I think I was originally quoting the fact that you have to deal with movie executives, and as the executives become younger and more corporate, they tend to have less background in movies. I mean, they probably all saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, and they probably, you know, they know the touchstones, but they don't really have a sense of that the older executives used to have of continuity, where these movies came from, and you know what built on what, and you know the famous anecdote about Fred Zinnemann, the director of High Noon, going for an interview with some young executive later in his career, and the kid says, "Well, so Mr. Zinnemann, what have you done?" And Zinnemann says, "No, you first." And it's sort of like that. But, you know, I think that, you know, there's the curmudgeon factor. When you get old and you're older than all the people that you're working for, which used to be the opposite for me. I used to be younger than all the people I worked for. You know, the game changes a little bit.
And you had that reverence for movies. Like when you go back and look at your biographies and things like that, when I did research, you cut your teeth. You watched all these movies in the 30s and the 40s and the grindhouse movies and the sci-fi and the stuff coming up. And I feel like that kind of informed a lot of your stuff. Obviously, you worked under Roger Corman. Nowadays, I think people like making movies and everyone's doing it on their iPhones and things like that. And while there are people out there who certainly love the genre of filmmaking, I feel like it's almost a stepping stone to wealth and fame for someone and not that love of movies that you seem to have been seeded with early on.
Well, there's always a contingent of people who are in it for the money or to get laid or whatever they think, get a swimming pool. but I think that's, particularly in genre movies, I find that is much less true. I think you find people who make these kind of pictures are much better versed in the history of the genre and who did what and, you know, the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And you get a real sense of continuity. Somebody like Edgar Wright or Guillermo del Toro, I mean, these people are huge movie buffs. I mean, they were movie buffs before they were film directors. And that was my situation as well.
And when you started out filmmaking, we go back to your very first movie you made. If this is correct, because I always like to ask because the internet gets it wrong sometimes, it was obviously Hollywood Boulevard. You shot it in 10 days for $60,000. And someone says that was almost a bet. Someone said you couldn't do it and you ended up doing it. Is that true?
Well, it sort of was a bet. I mean, my friend John Davison, who was the publicity director at New World at the time and who I share a film collection with, was working for Corman. And I was in the trailer department with Alan Arkush. And I think John made a bet with Roger that he could make a cheaper movie than anything Roger had made up to then at his non-union company. And so in 10 days and $60,000 and about 20 minutes of footage from other people's pictures so that we wouldn't have to do expensive action scenes, we made a movie about a movie company making exploitation movies. And when you look back at this movie, which is a very silly movie, but it's very accurate portrayal of what Hollywood was like on the low budget and in the mid-70s.
And you went on to do, obviously, many other films, Piranha, The Howling. We had Dee Wallace on the show a couple of years back, and she mentioned The Howling was one of the best things she ever did. She loved working specifically with you. And other people we've had on the show, acting-wise, have said the same thing. We love working with Joe Dante. We had John Glover. He said Gremlins 2 is probably one of his favorite movies that he's ever done. And everyone who we've had on the show who's worked with you has had nothing but rave reviews. To what would you attribute this? Is it your style? Is it the way you handle yourself on set? What would you think that would be?
Well, John and Dee are both among my favorite actors, and it's because I like actors. I mean, the one of the most fun things about making movies is working with the actors, because you may have the whole movie in your head, but when the actors get a hold of it, it becomes a whole different beast. And I can't tell you how many times on a movie set that an actor has ad-libbed a line that's better than the line that's in the script, and we've used it. And so I like to give actors as much freedom as possible. Obviously, if you cast the movie correctly, you don't have to do a lot of directing. If you haven't cast the movie correctly and you've got somebody in a part that they are uncomfortable in, then you've made a mistake. And then that's a lot of work to make that picture work and that casting piece work. But for the most part, I just find actors are, you know, one of the joys of making movies. And don't get me wrong. I mean, there can be difficult people or people who won't come out of their trailer or whatever, or having a bad day. But in the end, we're all in this together and everybody wants everybody else to look good.
You mentioned improv and things like that, having people do the lines. I also, again, it was a piece of trivia on IMDb, so I always like to vet it with someone like you who would know that The Burbs was filmed during the writer's strike of 1988, and so a lot of the lines were ad-libbed. Tom Hanks, Carrie Fisher, great cast, were ad-libbing some lines just because out of necessity at some points. Is there any truth to that?
Well, it is true, but the reason was that we were shooting the entire picture on one place at the Universal Backlot, which is a neighborhood, and the writers were going to be on strike, and I wasn't going to be able to have the writer on set, because I really like to have the writer on set. And in fact, I've sometimes had the writer flown down to do a part of the movie just to have them be there. John Sayles, I flew to Texas to work on Piranha. As he played a small part, but while he was there, we did a lot of writing. So it's great to have the writer there. But in this case, Dana Olsen, who wrote the script, was only on the set for one night because he was playing a cop at one point. But he wasn't allowed to write anything. And so I thought, well, you know, if we shoot this movie in sequence, then we can ad lib and not worry about it not matching something that we've already done in another location, because we're, and everybody will be finding their part. And so it was a journey of discovery. I mean, all the actors, you know, Bruce Dern and Rick Dukeman and Henry Gibson, all these people were literally creating their characters, you know, in real time on the set. And it was, that was one of the most fun movies I ever did.
As a naive child, I always thought movies were shot in the order in which they appear, not knowing, obviously, as a kid that this is not the case by any means. Did you find...
That's not very efficient.
Right, certainly. But I always thought, I'm like, oh, that's so cool. I guess they knew, you know. But looking back, seeing how things are shot, when you take a movie like the one you just mentioned, it was shot and you were going through it. Did you find that, like, boy, it'd be almost easier in some sense if movies were shot that way? The actors could find their character as they went?
Well, if you're doing something that's based on a stage play and you're doing it mostly in one room, then you have a lot of leeway. But if you do a movie with various locations,
right,
then you've got to do everything at the one location while you're there. You can't just come back, you know. So it becomes much more problematic. And then if you have actors who are not on a show and they have an out date, they have to leave at a certain point, then you have to shoot them out. You have to get rid of them so that they can go on to their next job, which means you have to move scenes up from the end and put them at the beginning. And I mean, most movies have been made in a haphazard manner that's like never in sequence, and that's why it's always so impressive to see them work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just looking at some of the stuff now, because we've got all these great documentaries and Netflix is doing stuff on the movies that made us, and we see all the trials and tribulations. And one of the reasons I like to own physical media is because the DVDs and Blu-rays have the director's commentary. They've got some behind the scenes shots and, you know, deleted scenes and things like that, which I think just adds to, wow, it's amazing this film got made.
Sure, and remember, owning physical media means that you aren't at the, working at the whim of some streamer who's decided that they don't want to stream that movie anymore.
Right.
So, you know, if you have it, you have it. And then if they want to go back and do censorship or recutting like they did with The French Connection, you know, you want to hold on to that disc that you've got that's the only version of the movie that's the actual real version that was released.
Yeah, one of my favorite sci-fi movies of all time, Blade Runner. I've got the collector's set that has the director's version, the theatrical release, and there's a few other cuts in there. And I think that's it's amazing when you look at the different, how much different each movie is, even if you take out Harrison Ford's voiceover. It's a completely different movie.
Yeah, that's true. And that's an extreme example because there's so many different versions of that particular picture. But I had a big 16mm film collection. And now they don't make the prints anymore, and they don't make the projectors anymore. And of course, the digital stuff is all taken from like very close to the original negatives, and they frankly look better than the 16mm, which I swore by. And I was kind of bummed when they moved from 35mm to shooting on digital, because I thought, well, but it's film, you know, I don't want to give up film.
Yeah.
And there are certain directors who insist on shooting on film and releasing on film, but only very high echelon directors who can afford to do that. But I find that the technical quality of the transfers on digital is often as good or better than they were in 35.
And then when you see movies like that are now out, Oppenheimer, filmed in IMAX, exclusively on IMAX, it's just it's a different style of filmmaking and it has a different element to it. Do you prefer, like when you're viewing a movie, are you able to shut off the director's part of your brain and say, okay, I'm just going to enjoy this film? Or do you kind of like, this should have been shot like this, I wish IMAX would have done differently here, or something like that at all?
No, I think if you're doing that kind of thinking, then you're not, the movie isn't working for you. You know, if you're free to make those kind of associations, then you're not caught up in the picture. And I like movies that, you know, I watch movies like anybody else. I mean, I don't think about the complications of how it was made unless there's some specifically outrageous shot that you go, wow, this been going on for a long time. You know, but for the most part, I see movies the way the audience does. I just want the story to be good. I want to be moved.
we're in the middle of award seasons. I mentioned Oppenheimer. Is there a particular movie or a few movies out of the current crop that you really thought just raised the bar or nailed it in 2023?
Well, I really like Poor Things, which has some of the most amazing art direction since Michael Powell. I mean, it's just, it's really a phenomenal looking movie. And I happened to see Anatomy of a Fall recently, which I had avoided because somebody said, well, you know, it's a murder mystery with no solution. It runs 2.5 hours. And I'm not a fan of the fact that all the movies today run 3 hours
right.
long. And so I think, well, this better be good if it's going to take. And I watched it, and because Sandra Hüller, the star, is so great in this movie. She just makes this entire thing work. And it's essentially a long courtroom drama, but it's really compelling. And I was very impressed with it.
With the stuff you've worked on, I was noticing some of the stuff you had been approached to work on but didn't. And I there were so many of these movies, and my mind started going like, well, what would this movie have been like if Joe Dante did direct it? For example, you were one of the directors considered for Jurassic Park. You were John Carpenter's choice for Halloween 3, Seasons of the Witch, which is severely underrated in the Halloween franchise because it doesn't involve Michael Myers. But you, right. There was talk of you possibly, or at least you wanted to direct the 1989 Batman that ended up going to Tim Burton. There was even talk of you directing a Bond film in the 90s. When you look back at some of these movies, are there ones that would have particularly, you think, oh, I would have done this differently? Or when you're detached from the project, is it just, well, that's it, moving on, and no regrets?
Well, I don't think there's really any regrets. I mean, if you get fired off something, then that's a regret.
Yeah.
But if you're some of the movies you talked about, I was planning to make, and then something else came along that was a sure thing that was going to happen. Whereas the other thing I was doing, like Halloween 3, was a development deal basically. But then the Twilight Zone movie came along, and that was an actual movie that I told John I'm sorry, but I had to leave. And then some of the other ones, Jurassic Park, you know, I mean, there were four different studios, that were vying for Michael Crichton's book. And, I was with one studio, Richard Donner was with another. I can't remember who the other guy was, but then there was Steven. And of course he chose the guy who could build him a theme park, which I certainly wasn't surprised about.
Sure. The Bond movie one fascinates me, though, because we've had Martin Campbell on the show. We've had John Glenn on the show because I'm a huge Bond fan. Were you a huge James Bond fan growing up? Was this something that would have been just a job? And what would a James Bond film with you have looked like, do you think?
No, I of course, always enjoyed James Bond. And I saw Dr. No when it was new, and it was like a revelation. I mean, that's a movie where the hero gets to shoot people, and it's okay. but there was a Bond movie where they were having some production problems, and the director was going to leave. And so the Broccolis, who are the people who produce those things, asked me to come in and read the script and think about coming and taking over. But then they managed to resolve their problems, and I have to do it. But they did send me a lovely case of wine.
Oh, nice. Well, that's definitely a perk. One of the big movies too, because I'm such a fan, if I had to like get rid of all of my physical media as far as TV shows, except for one TV show, I would keep Rod Serling's Twilight Zone, the box sets that I have of that. Obviously, you did the 1983 movie, The Twilight Zone. You got to do one of the segments taken from It's a Good Life. With that particular one, what was it like working on The Twilight Zone, the movie, in your experience?
Well, initially, it was going to be just me and it was going to be just Landis and Spielberg. And then I was added, and then George Miller was added. Mm-hmm. So now there were four stories and a wraparound. The thing that I objected to, which I just didn't understand why they were going to do it, the studio insisted on remaking episodes of the TV show. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, but so many of these episodes, they rest on twist endings. And if you do them over again, the audience is going to already know how it ends. So don't you, and the show was famous for taking great science fiction novels and stories and horror stories and turning them into these half hour dramas. So why don't we do that? And they said, no, we have to, if we're going to make this movie, we have to do adaptations of the old episodes. And so I chose it's a good life because I went back to this original story by Jerome Bixby, and which is quite different than the TV version. And I thought, well, if I can redo this story in a way that the audience doesn't recognize which episode it's a remake of, then I'll at least get them involved in it before they start to figure out, you know, the twist. And so Richard Matheson, who is a wonderful writer, and I was very lucky to know, who you know, came in and did a complete revamp of Bixby's original idea, and it was really a fun thing to do. It was my first studio movie, and I felt like I was, you know, I had arrived. I mean, here I was at Warner Brothers, you know, all my other pictures were independent, and here I was at a big studio, and I was on these big sets. And I remember a grip came over to me and he said, "Kid, you see that corner?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Errol Flynn pissed in that corner." And I remember thinking, "Boy, I've really arrived in Hollywood."
No kidding. Good. That's they probably, like, you know, glazed over it so it wouldn't spoil the ambiance of Errol Flynn's excrement, I suppose.
It was one of those sets that had a big, I guess it was the seawall or something, one of those sets that had a big hole in it that you could float a boat and stuff. We were just working on the top of it.
Obviously, that movie also had the tragedy, Vic Morrow and the two children, and that was by the part of the segment, directed by John Landis. If I'm not mistaken, you had to come in and finish some editing because John was so distressed about what had happened. Having that be your first, as you said, big studio film and have kind of a pall cast over it, did that dampen your enthusiasm at all? I mean, I can't imagine it wouldn't have been quite heartbreaking and have to be attached to it, but at the same time, the show must go on,
well,
as they say.
It was an odd situation because John had been doing his own episode on his own ahead of the other episodes as a sort of a separate unit. Because he was going to often do something else, and so he said he had to do his first. And once the accident happened, I think the rest of us felt that, well, this movie's obviously going to get canceled. And but for whatever reason, the studio wanted this Twilight Zone movie, and I think largely because they wanted a Spielberg-Landis movie, and they went ahead with it. And so George and I were actually the beneficiaries of it, because our episodes got noticed much more than the other two. And it was kind of a stepping stone for us both. And it was exciting to work at a big studio and have all this, you know, support from all this technical stuff, all these people who knew what they were doing, and all these, you know, people had expertise in different areas. And everybody left us alone because it was kind of a hot potato because of the accident.
Yeah.
And so we got to do exactly what we wanted. And both George and I thought, wow, boy, this is great working at these big studios. They leave you alone. They give you lots of money. we realized on our next pictures that this was kind of unique, and that's not really the way the studio system works.
And it's one of those movies where you don't see a lot of anthology type movies like this. I can think of, like, one of my favorite movies, Four Rooms, is one of those movies where it's got four separate stories that are kind of loosely connected. Tim Roth and the bellhop in that one. But I that's one of the things I enjoyed about the movie, is it is so unique in that aspect where you get these distinct separate stories. And I think that would have been an amazing first project as a, you know, for you to work on it at the big studio like that.
Well, I think directors really like those multi-story pictures because if you're just doing one of the stories, you don't have to carry the movie. Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot more freedom to do whatever you want. I mean, you know, Creepshow is a great example of a multi-story picture, which of course has the Stephen King connection. And they were particularly popular in Europe, this kind of movie, for all through the 60s and 70s. I don't know why it was so much more popular in Europe than it was in America.
We mentioned early on Roger Corman, obviously early influencer, and you worked with him, New World Pictures and everything like that. It's listed still in pre-production. And if you don't mind my asking, I'm just curious, is there any movement on The Man with the Kaleidoscope Eyes? I know we got the graphic novel that came out. There was the table read in the Vista Theater back in 2016 with Bill Hader and Jason Ritter and Ethan Embry. Is there any word on anything on that?
I would love to say yes, but there isn't. Well, you know, COVID didn't help.
Oh, sure.
And then the fact that the business has changed so immensely in terms of what gets made and who makes it and where it gets seen, that there's a lot of consternation in Hollywood about, you know, where it's all going, where is it all headed. and who's going to finance these movies and who's going to distribute them? Are they going to be on streaming? Are they going to be in theaters? It's a very topsy turvy moment. So it's been particularly difficult for independent films to get the stuff off the ground.
Which is sad, too, because I've remarked to a friend of mine, he does a show on this station as well, Max on Movies, how a lot of the independent, smaller budget films, I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older and my sensibilities have changed, but I find myself gravitating more towards those than the big Hollywood studio blockbusters. And I'm not sure if it's just because the indie ones are more story-driven, better made.
Well, that's because the indie ones aren't just people in capes.
Yeah.
Flying around, you know. I mean, the blockbuster mentality has been, if something's successful, make more of it. Mm-hmm. And so now superhero movies, they run like 2.5-3 hours because they have so many characters that they have to deal with and have so many stories to tell and so many climaxes to overcome. And so you can't have a movie that just has one ending anymore. You have to have five endings.
Right.
And each ending has to top the next ending. And frankly, it's kind of boring. And I think that the bloom is a little off the rose. I think some of the most recent efforts in this regard have been not that well received. And of course, it costs a fortune to make these things. And so I think that there's more head scratching going on about, you know, what are the studios going to do? What are they going to make? You know, if a picture like Oppenheimer, which is not your average movie, is made by Universal Pictures, that's the kind of movie that studios used to make in the 70s. Mm-hmm. You know, movies mm-hmm. with plot, movies with characters, movies that were about something. And that's sort of frittered away to the independent world. Now, the independents are the ones who are making those kind of stories. But I think the studios are starting to realize that, you know, there's a lot of money to be made from intelligent audiences with good pictures. And I think the Barbenheimer, you know, phenomenon, I think it's had some repercussions. I think they really started to think about, you know, the kind of things that they're doing that maybe isn't just a reboot of something that they made 2 years ago or another Harry Potter movie because they're always looking for that. The Harry Potter franchise is the thing that makes them just so
sure.
So crazy. They just slather at the mouth thinking about, can we do another one of those? You know, and they tried it with Fantastic Beasts and it didn't work.
Right.
So they're always looking for something that they can turn into a money, you know, a machine, but it's not that easy to do. And now they're actually going back to the Hunger Games, you know, and
right.
they've got a prequel to the Hunger Games. I mean, there's only so many ways that you can squeeze these turnips before there's no more juice in them.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, you know, there's that debate because comic book movies have been huge since Iron Man's 2008. I mean, going back further, you can speculate, you know, a lot of the comic book movies that were out before the Marvel Cinematic Universe were huge. But now they're kind of, like you said, the bloom is off the rose. Some people are saying, oh, they're too much messaging. And some people are saying, no, it's comic book fatigue. But it sounds like you're in the same kind of camp with Martin Scorsese, who famously said they're like theme parks. They don't mean anything. They're just, you know, is that kind of your feeling? Or are you also just...
We'll see what his feeling is, whether or not he agrees with Martin Scorsese about that point or if he feels slightly differently. Before we take this commercial break, I want to make sure we tell you about our official comic book sponsor, Bugs Comics and Games. Go over to their brick and mortar store. That's right, their brick and mortar store right there on Bryan Road in O'Fallon, Missouri. You can find them there to buy your back issues, new issues, toys, games. I was just in there, picked up my new pull list. If you make sure you want to get your comics, if like, oh man, this issue of Ultimate Spider-Man was sold out, or I wanted that new issue of She-Hulk and it was sold out before the time I got there, the new issue of Wolverine, whatever it might be, now that they're doing that Joker origin story in the pages of the current Batman title, you might want to make sure you don't miss one of those issues. So talk to Larry, say, hey, I want to start a pull list. These are the books I want on my pull list, so we can put them aside for you every single week. As soon as they come out, you can go and then at your leisure and pick them up. No worries about missing your books. And if you join the Avengers Club on top of that, you'll start saving money on your weekly books, on your back issues, on your toys, your games, your Pokemon cards, your bags, your boards, whatever it might be that you want to get. If you are not in the greater St. Louis, St. Charles area, find Bugs Comics and Games on Facebook. facebook.com/bugscomicsandgames, or go to their Instagram, instagram.com/bugscomicsandgames, games and spelt out, Bugs Comics and Games. Follow them on Instagram. He puts up books on there every so often that you can buy, so you don't have to be in this area to pick up a comic. He puts some good books up there, too, and it might be something like, oh, my gosh, I haven't seen that book in forever. Oh, my gosh, my local comic book store where I am didn't carry that. Get it from Larry. Save yourself the headache. He'll ship it right to your door very safe and securely, so you can do that. Bugs Comics and Games. Very proud to have them as the official comic book sponsor here on Geek to Me Radio. With that said, we are going to take a quick commercial break. We're going to come right back. We're going to continue talking with director Joe Dante. You're listening to Geek to Me Radio on the Big 550 KTRS. Please stand by.
Hi, this is John Glover, and you're listening to Geek to Me Radio. I love a good geek.
Heard here every Sunday night on the Big 550 KTRS. I'm your host, James Enstall. Want to make sure we tell you about our premier sponsor, the people with whom, I should say without whom, we would not still be on the air, and that, of course, is the Greater St. Charles Convention and Visitors Bureau. Of course, the website, discoverstcharles.com. Something big is brewing in St. Charles. We'll talk to you more about that as the in the next coming weeks as we approach my 400th episode. If you've not been to the city of St. Charles lately, you are missing out on some great deals of fun. They've got shopping, they've got dining, they've got festivals, they've got music, they've got stuff going on all the time. You can find out more about it. Go to that website that I just mentioned, discoverstcharles.com. That's discoverstcharles.com. You can check all the cool stuff that is going on out there. Their Valentine's Festival, their inaugural edition of that, was a huge success a couple weekends back. If it's not a holiday festival, there's an ice show. They've got Food Truck Day going on. They've always got something cool. Heritage Day should be coming up here in April, and it's a great time to be out in St. Charles no matter what time it is. So whether you're near or far, if you're in California, if you're in New York, if you're in Florida, or if you're right in Alton, Illinois, or maybe you're in Edwardsville, Illinois, maybe you're in Joplin, Missouri, and you haven't made the trip to St. Charles, start now. Start at the website, discoverstcharles.com. Plan your trip. Discover St. Charles. As we always say, it's an historically good time. Talking with Joe Dante, the legendary director, asked him as we went to that last commercial break if he agreed with Martin Scorsese's thoughts on comic book movies. Are they just you know, fairground, playground entertainment?
I think each one is different, but I tend to agree. I think Marty is a little depressed that, you know, the kind of movies that he grew up loving are even his latest pictures have been bankrolled by Netflix. You know, yeah. which without Netflix, there was a whole lot of stuff that would never have gotten done. You can argue about, you know, theaters and, you know, all that, but that's a whole different thing. But the fact is that they have stepped up to the plate. And Netflix, if it wasn't for Netflix, there Orson Welles' last picture would never have been rescued from oblivion. Mm. So, I mean, there is something to be said for that source of financing and the fact that they've made some pretty memorable things. They've made some junk too, but you know, you never know when you're making things whether they're going to turn out well or not.
Yeah. I think too, like I mentioned earlier, I feel like I remember when I was younger, we had six channels to watch TV on. If you had cable, that was something, but I would come home and often watch a movie or a DVD. I'd plop it in the thing and VHS tapes and everything. I'd watch movies that I really enjoyed 6, 7, 8, 9 times. Probably the last time I did that was early 2000s because there's such a glut of content. And for this radio show, I have to consume so much of it. I don't have the luxury of going back and visiting movies again and again. Do you think that might contribute to the fact that because there's so much content, the quality overall has declined?
I wouldn't say necessarily that the quality has declined, except that you hit on a very salient point, which is there's more content now available than there has ever been in my lifetime. And that includes, by the way, movies that have been resuscitated from 70 years ago.
Yeah.
They found them and they put them back out, and it's like now you could see it and you couldn't see it for years. So that's another thing. Often from sources that you have no idea what they are. I got the Peacock Network and I watched that great show with Natasha Lyonne, and it was great, but I never would have seen it otherwise. But they're cutting their own throats because what you can do is you can sign up and you can watch the show and binge it, and then you can unsign up.
Yeah.
And the whole thing with binging is that, you know, when House of Cards did it for the first time, everybody said, this is amazing. Now we can watch a whole show, a whole season. We can just spend the whole week watching this one show. And so and they did, and people started to get into that groove. The problem with that, as opposed to the way that it used to be done, which is that something was on every week, once a week. Well, during that week between the two shows, people would talk about what they had seen.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they would anticipate seeing the next one. But if you watch them all at once and you've gone through them all, then that's history. You've already done that. And that's not something that's part of your mind anymore. So that it doesn't have the kind of shelf life that it would have if you had to wait for it. When I was a kid, Twilight Zone only came on once a week. Thriller came on once a week. Outer Limits came on once a week. But all the shows were pretty memorable. And then they went into syndication. And on syndication, which doesn't exist anymore, you'd be able to watch these things on the local channels, you know, for years and years and years under the same circumstances. Now, the only way you can watch those shows is like you can watch Twilight Zone if you have the Sci-Fi channel and they're doing a marathon.
Yeah.
Or you can go to Amazon Prime and you could probably watch it, a number of those things. But there's so much content and that you can't keep up with it. There's no way you can see all. When the Emmy Awards list comes out and you look at it, you go, there's no way anybody could ever see this. It's bad enough with the Academy Awards. You can't see all the movies. But for the Emmys, there's no way you could see all these things. It's
right.
Impossible.
Yeah, and to your point, too, I was just having this discussion with a friend of mine, and I think it's because we binge them. Series aren't as memorable. Like, if you had to wait each week, like I know some streaming services have gone back to that, like Severance, you had to wait each week on Apple TV for the next episode to drop. And it stayed with me more. I think some series, I'm going back now and watching Monk for the first time on Amazon Prime with my wife. And I'm like, ooh, yeah, that episode kind of sounds familiar, but wasn't that the previous episode? And it kind of blends together when you're binging. I think when you had to watch them episodically week by week, they stick with you more.
You can actually get confused when you're watching them because you can't tell whether have you skipped ahead and is that episode ahead of the one you're supposed to be watching? Because I'm watching For All Mankind, which I did not start watching when it came on 4 years ago, but now I've caught up with it and I'm in season four. But sometimes when I put it on, I can't tell whether this is the episode I just saw or whether it's the next episode. It's a great show. But there's just so many things vying for people's eyeballs. It's even amazing with, you know, it's not just that, it's video games. It's, you know, all the other things that they could be doing. They're not just all watching TV. So it's become a pastime in a way, but it's not the obsession that it was when we were growing up.
Yeah, sure. I want to make sure we talk about Gremlins because this year is the 40th anniversary of the movie. And
God help us.
It's amazing because my wife, we usually sit down and watch Christmas movies every season. And I said, have you ever seen Gremlins? And she hadn't. So I said, okay, we've got to sit down and watch this movie then, because I watched this when I was really little, probably too young to watch it. But she hadn't seen it before, and she is, wow, I really enjoyed that. But at first, it took her a while because it is a horror movie. There is comedy. It's set at Christmas time. And I remember kind of thinking there really wasn't much like this at the time that kind of blended horror and comedy so well and also had the through line of Christmas. If you would talk a little bit about your experience with Gremlins.
Well, you know, when Gremlins is something I'm very glad I got the chance to make it. I'll never live it down. I mean, when the headline says bus hits Gremlins director, you know, I die. I'll always be the Gremlins director, which is fine. You know, I like the movie, but none of us realized when we were doing the picture that it was going to have the kind of staying power that it's had. I mean, this is 40 years is a long time. And, you know, when you make these movies, you think, well, you know, hope people will like them this summer and then, you know, they'll go into reruns and then, you know, they'll just be an old movie. But for some reason, and I think I have an inkling what the reason is, this particular picture has stood the test of time more than all of its competition, more than, you know, a lot of the other kind of movies that were coming out in the 80s. And my view is that the key to the whole thing is that, you know, Steven Spielberg made a particular decision in pre-production of this movie Since the original script by Chris Columbus, which he wrote as a spec, which is a spec script, is a script that people write not knowing if it's ever going to get produced, but just to show what they can do. And it was a horror film. It was a fairly gruesome horror film. And this was Steven Spielberg's first production for Amblin, his new company. And he obviously wanted to play it safe. And he figured if he made a horror film, then they're usually pretty successful. And so that was a safe bet. So while we were planning the movie and designing the characters and all that kind of stuff, one of the characters is this little mogwai called Gizmo. And in Chris's original script, he turns into the bad gremlin after about half hour. And then the rest of the movie is gremlins doing the things that gremlins do. And at one point, dangerously close to when we were actually going to shoot, Stephen decided that he saw some rushes of Gizmo, and he said, you know, I really like this character, and I don't think he should turn into the bad gremlin. I think he should stick around and be the hero's pal. And that, of course, terrified us, because the little mechanical thing we were dealing with was not going to be able to carry a movie. I mean, we just had figured we'd dispense with it after 20 minutes. And so we had to do a lot of R&D in figuring out how to make this little thing into a character that was going to last through a whole movie. But my feeling over the years has been that if that decision hadn't been made, Gremlins would be no more popular than Critters or Ghoulies or any of the other kind of movies like that that came out. I think it's the bond between – it's a boy and his dog movie.
Yeah.
He's already got a dog, but I mean, but it's basically the relationship between the hero and this little fuzzy critter is the heart of the movie. And it's, I think, the reason that the movie has managed to sustain itself over these years.
I know Phoebe Cates' speech about how she lost her dad and why she hates Christmas. From what I understand, you had to fight to keep that speech in because the higher ups were like, ah, it's too dark. We don't want it. But that was, you felt that was integral to that. Was that one of the first times you've had to really go to the mat for a particular aspect of a film?
Well, I did go to the mat for it because I felt that it encapsulated the entire movie for me. I mean, it's a story that to this person is a terrible tragedy, but it's basically absurd. And it's sort of like if you watch somebody slipping on a banana peel from across the street, it might be funny. But if you're the one who slipped on the banana peel and you broke your back, that's not funny.
Sure.
And so that kind of dichotomy is, you know, on display throughout the entire picture. And I said, you know, I really think, and also she's really good in the scene. And otherwise, her character doesn't have an arc. She doesn't have a character. She's just the girl. And so I fought for it. And Stephen backed me up. And the studio was very happy when they went to the premiere and everybody loved it, but now all you have to do is cut that scene. they even had measurements taken so they could send them to the projectionists so they could cut the scene out in the theaters. And Stephen put a stop to that, obviously. And it became a kind of a talking point about the movie, which was good. And it allowed us to make fun of it in the sequel because it became such a memorable moment. And I've always been very happy that it was in the movie. And I think she's one of the best things Phoebe ever did.
And I know that, again, in the trivia realm, I'm told that at least until recently, you still owned the Peeler Pelt, the Peltzer Peeler juicer. Are you sentimental? Do you keep stuff from film shoots at all?
I don't keep very many, but I kept some gremlins and I kept some of the props from the Peltzer inventions, which were so clever and silly. But then, you know, people have come up to me and said, I'll give you lots of money for it. Or, you know, and I at one point I told Warner Brothers, do you guys want to take these and, you know, put them in the Warner Brothers Museum or whatever? And they weren't interested.
Really?
So I've still got a couple of them. But over the years, I've let some of them go.
And I know another thing about Gremlins is this was one of the movies along with Temple of Doom that came out in the same year that instituted the PG-13 rating due to some, you know, people saying, well, this is a little too gruesome, too violent. Same with Temple of Doom. Do you think the adding the rating has helped or hurt the movie industry as a whole, or was it kind of a non-issue?
No, I think it's, you know, the movie is actually still officially rated PG.
Yeah.
They created the PG-13, but they didn't apply it retroactively, so the movie is still PG. But the reason that people were upset was because it was advertised as if it was ET2. It had this box with a little furry hand coming out of it, and the colors were exactly the same colors as the ET poster. And people brought their kids thinking they were going to see a Disney movie. And for the first, 25 minutes of the movie, it is a Disney movie. And then it's not. And then when around the time they got to the microwave scene, they were upset. So I reenacted that in the sequel. There's a scene where the mother comes out with her daughter and complaining that this movie is too violent for their kids. And I saw that happen in the screening at Warner Brothers. There was a woman who stormed out of the picture right around that time, and the kid got away from her and ran back into the theater and hid, and she couldn't find it. So I'm standing next to this woman for the whole second half of the movie, and she's angry as hell, and her kid is hiding somewhere in the theater watching the rest of the movie.
This was one of the ones, too. If I'm not mistaken, there was the original rough cut ended up being 2 hours and 40 minutes. Is this one of those? Because I know people now want the director's cut. We needed the Snyder cut of Justice League. People are wanting the Schumacher cut of Batman Forever. Yeah,
no, that was not a contentious cut. No, it was long because it was just long.
Okay.
And we did a lot of things with the puppets that didn't work. And we had a lot of subplot about Mrs. Deagle taking over the town with the chemical company and all that. And it just sort of we just jettisoned it after we had our first preview because this isn't really germane to the story. So there's some of that stuff is still available to see on the DVD outtakes. Because one of the great things about DVDs was that, all the things that people were told that they had to cut out of their movies and used to just disappear into the garbage are now they now save them. And now they can use them as DVD extras. And so almost everybody can get their missing scenes seen by somebody. And if somebody wants to go to the trouble to try to reconstitute the movie, put those scenes back, well, they can do that. And people do that on YouTube.
And I can't remember which movie it was, but I know you've utilized the actor Dick Miller in just about all of your films. There was one, I can't remember which film, I feel like most of his scenes were cut, but I'm assuming it's one of those things, again, now we can see those on the DVD and everything like that.
Well, he was in The Amazon Woman on the Moon, which is a sketch movie that I did.
Oh, that's it, okay.
A bunch of other directors, and he had a skit that he did called The French Ventriloquist Dummy, which got cut from the theatrical, but it's available on the Shout Factory version. There's a lot of missing scenes. Yeah, John Landis was the producer, and he kept we shot that in 85, and it wasn't released until 87 because he kept changing it. He kept trying out different versions, cutting out this scene and moving this story around. And that one story was like 20 minutes long, and he just cut it. So if you get the Shout Factory DVD, it has a lot of interesting things in it.
One of the movies I wanted to mention too, because I loved it so much as a child, was Inner Space. This was one of the ones my sister and her boyfriend took me to see, and they probably shouldn't have taken me to see at the age I was, but it was my introduction to Martin Short. But that movie was so inventive, and if I'm not mistaken, that's an Academy Award winning movie that was for visual effects.
Yeah, it's as close to an Academy Award as I'm going to give. But I don't think there was anything that you shouldn't see in that picture.
Yeah, looking back, I couldn't think. But
I can understand other movies that I've made where you say the kid is not old enough. But Inner Space is not particularly adult movie, I don't think.
Yeah, looking back, I couldn't figure out why my mom got mad at my sister for bringing me. But, it's one of those movies that just always has been such a special place with me. I think I've loved Martin Short ever since then. Martin Short, Christopher Lee, John Goodman, you've worked with so many great actors. And you've got, obviously, other ones like Robert Picardo and Dick Miller, who are in nearly all your films. Is this going back to what we talked about at the very beginning? You just love actors?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the perks about doing these movies for me was that I got to work with people that I'd grown up watching, people who were my favorite actors, Kevin McCarthy, I put him in like everything. And even better, you become friends with them. I mean, they're actually part of your life. Not just part of your movie, but part of your life. And so when you're reading a script and you're trying to cast it in your head. You always go through your list of people that you know are good and you know will be good in the movie. You don't want to miscast them just to have them in the movie. But if there's something that's right for them, you definitely want to use them because you have this shorthand with them that you don't even have to direct them. I mean, they just know what you want and you know what they want. And it just makes it so much easier because it's really not easy making movies. It's quite difficult.
Well, I'm sure.
The easier you can make it, the better the movie.
Yeah. And I know we're coming up on the end of our time. I just have one or two more things I want to try to get to because you've obviously directed a lot of episodes of television and you did dip your foot in the comic book end of the pool with Legends of Tomorrow, the episode Night of the Hawk, where they go back to the small town in Oregon in the 1950s investigating the string of murders as they're tracking down Vandal Savage. We've had a couple directors who've worked on these DC projects and they say it's so much fun because you're just in there. It's like a plug and play. The actors pretty much already know their stuff. You come in and get to direct. Did you have that same experience? Did you find directing Legends of Tomorrow just a very easy, and not easy per se, but a fun endeavor?
Well, I enjoyed it and I enjoyed the actors, but the problem with some of these shows, and this one in particular, is that they're overscheduled. And what happens is that sometimes directors have to leave and they're not done with their episode. And so what you inherit is this morning you're going to shoot this scene from this other episode that hasn't been done yet with a script you haven't even read. And so I spent a lot of my time on that show shooting pieces of other people's episodes so that when I got to the end of my episode, naturally, I didn't get to finish it because I still had stuff left to shoot. And I find that that's a recurring problem on television. Hmm. It was true on Hawaii Five-0 also. I mean, the thing about television is that they don't have a lot of money and they don't have a lot of time, but they want everything to look like a feature film.
Yeah.
And sometimes that leads to, well, it can lead to, you know, dangerous stunts and things going badly because you're in such a hurry. But sometimes it leads to, you know, stoppages when the actors just say, look, this doesn't make sense. I just did this in this scene and now this doesn't, because the writing sometimes is done by a group of people who aren't necessarily in communication with each other. And the actors are the ones who have to make sense out of it on the stage. And sometimes they get to a point where they just go, this doesn't work. We just got to sit down and rewrite it. Well, that's money. I mean, anytime you're going to not shoot, that's money. Television is it's interesting, but it reminded me of my Corman days because you have to go so fast, but it can be very tense.
You did all the way back to Police Squad too, which is, for my money, is one of the most hysterical TV series of all time, right there with Get Smart, working with the great Leslie Nielsen. Was it still the same then? Everything rushed, everything kind of hurry, or
That was a little different because the Police Squad was my first DGA show, Directors Guild show, which means you have to give all your salary to the Directors Guild in order to get in. The Zuckers, who did Airplane, were friends of mine. They wanted to do an episode of Police Squad. I ended up doing two of them. There are only six, and they would come up with stuff. And you'd shoot a scene and then you'd go to the next scene. They'd go, oh, wait, I thought of something funnier. You got to go back and reshoot that. So that kind of got to be a little annoying. But you always had Leslie with his fart machine to make everything better because he had this little fart machine that he used to carry around. And if you were in an elevator with him, he would press the fart machine and then he would point at some little girl in the elevator. It was one of the favorite things he liked to do. And so it was a fun show to do. It was a great show and it was a wonderful show, but it didn't work because it didn't have a laugh track. Mm. And that was why it was great. But it looked so much like an old 60s TV show, which was their intention, that when people switched the channel, they said, oh, there's Leslie Nielsen on our old TV show. And they switched the channel back because they didn't hear that. They didn't leave it on long enough to know that it was funny. And it was hilarious. I mean, it was a hilarious show. Much better, I think, than the feature film versions.
Yeah.
Because they parodied all the things, the commercials and the episode titles and the freeze frames at the end and all that. I mean, they just did all this television stuff and they really did it well. And it was, I love doing it. I wish I had done more.
Yeah.
But the show went on. Nobody knew about it. They kept moving it around. The last one that I did, I don't think was on for 2 months after the previous one. And it was just, it's just amazing that they were able to resuscitate that into a series.
And my very last question, because I know I've got to let you go here, because there are so many sequels that have come out at 30 years after the fact. We've had Top Gun Maverick. We're getting all these films that are coming out, Blade Runner 2049, and now they're talking Gladiator 2 coming from Ridley Scott. Is there any talk of a Gremlins 3? Because I know John Glover has said he would be in no matter how you have to bring him back for it. He would be down to do it. Any talk of a Gremlins 3?
Well, John is actually in the Gremlins TV show, the cartoon show.
Oh, fantastic.
That was just on. It's called Gremlins Secrets of the Mogwai. It was on Max. There were 10 episodes. So there's 10 more episodes. There's season 2 that hasn't been on yet. And John is in that. He did some voices for that. So he's still connected to the franchise. I love John. He turned a character in that sequel who would have been an ordinary, browbeaten, beetled villain into this hilarious, likable guy because of John. He just has this charisma about him, and he made this guy who is basically partly based on Donald Trump into a really likable villain. And I've never been able to work with him again. I don't know why, but he's one of my favorite actors. And as for Gremlins 3, there's constant bogus stories about Gremlins 3 because, you know, Zach Galligan loves to go around and talk about Gremlins 3 is going to get made. But I have seen absolutely no movement in that area whatsoever. And there's no guarantee that I would have anything to do with it anyway, because Chris Columbus owns it. He wasn't a big fan of the sequel. I have no idea it's too valuable a title not for something to happen eventually.
Yeah,
that's obviously why they ended up with the cartoon show. But it'll happen if it happens.
let's hope so. And if people want to keep up with you, I know we talked at the very beginning, you will be appearing at Pensacon down in Pensacola, Florida, this very end of February here. If people are looking to go to that, you can get tickets now. They are on sale, and it's a fantastic event.
And I'll be plugging my podcast, which I should have done here.
Yes, please
Movies
do.
Movies That Made Me, which I do with Josh Olson. It's an adjunct of Trailers from Hell, my website, which I also recommend. I'm sure I'll be hawking it to Pensacon.
And you're on Twitter, I know, at @Joe_Dante. Are you active on other social medias as well?
Who has time?
Yeah, this is true. It is the bane of my existence personally, but I didn't.
Yeah, at least I don't have to watch all the stuff you have to watch.
This is true. You're a lucky man in many respects, more so than I am. But this has just been an absolute delight to talk to you. I really appreciate your time. A great conversation with a great guy. Make sure you check out Pensacon next weekend if you get the chance to go. Fabulous, fabulous event that we try to go to. I won't be able to go this year, sadly. But hopefully in coming years, I'll be able to revisit Pensacon in Pensacola, Florida. Thank you to Joe Dante. Thank you to the Greater St. Charles Convention and Visitors Bureau, DiscoverStCharles.com, and to Bugs Comics and Games, Bugs Comics Games on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you to all of you for listening. This is episode 398. Two more to go before 400. Can't wait for you to hear our big announcement, episode 400. Max on Movies is up next with his reviews of Madam Web and Argyle. Until next week, my friends.
That's our show! This is Geek to Me Radio!
Thank you, New York. Good night.
Hey, kids. Are your parents about to buy you a shiny new toy from Amazon?
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
Well, don't be selfish. Share some of that money with us. Before going on Amazon, make sure to type in bit.ly/geektome in the web browser. It will look just like Amazon.com, except it'll say referral Geek to Me Radio up top. And then when you check out, a tiny percentage will go to support the show without costing you 1 cent more. So before your parents get you that gizmo, gadget, or widget, make sure they type in bit.ly/geektome in the web browser.
bit.ly/geektome, bit.ly/geektome.